Good morning. My name is John Sams. Registration number is 10680, and I represent the defendant and appellant American Family. May it please the court. I think I need to start and address the Kisselman case pursuant to the court's order. Obviously, it's a significant development. So I think that it's, number one, I think that it appears that there's really no disagreement that the two statutes that we're really talking about here, 10-3-11-15 and 10-3-11-16, do not apply and were not intended to apply retrospectively. The Kisselman court didn't really reach that conclusion specifically as a holding because the parties kind of withdrew that argument before it reached that point. But I don't really think there's any argument that the statutes were intended to apply retrospectively. So the issue really, I think, that Kisselman gives rise to here is, number one, on its face, does it apply to the facts in the Beccaro case? And number two, is it a retrospective application if the statutes are applied to the Beccaro case? So those are the two issues that I think arise out of the Kisselman decision. I think that the Kisselman case, one thing that is significant here is that the court refers to the logical extreme of the argument made by American Family in that case, and it wasn't me, although I was the unfortunate recipient of the arbitration award in that case. On the defense side, of course, if the what the court said is that by using the example of a policyholder making a claim the day before the statutes became effective would not be able to bring an action under the statutes for delay or denial starting on August 5th. So that the logical extreme is that it doesn't make sense. And the court says twice in that opinion that statutes are construed and intended, the courts will assume that the legislature intended a reasonable and just result. Now, applying that here, the case is distinguishable because it really ends up being a retrospective application on our facts here. The only activity that occurred after the statute's enactment arose because of a letter that was sent by counsel to American Family saying, here's something else we want you to look at, notwithstanding the fact that on January 30 of 2008, some 7 months before the statute became effective, American Family had said, we are making a final offer to you for underinsured motorist benefits. That's Trial Exhibit J. And so after that, a letter comes in from counsel with a supposed IME from another doctor that they say we want you to look at. Now, this puts insurers, if we're going to construe the statute this way to apply to these facts, it creates an impossible catch-22, or Hobbesian choice, I think is the term we used in the brief, for insurance companies. Your options are total capitulation, review something that comes in, or not review it. No matter what they do, the argument is that the statutes are going to apply, and a jury should be allowed to determine whether there was whether the insurance company lacked a reasonable basis for maintaining its claim decision that was made before the statutes became effective on August 5 of 2008. Again, I think it's critically important here that the Kisselman case does not give any factual context for how it would be applied in that case, because that really wasn't before the court.
Mr. Sands, here we've got an actual trial that takes place given and some jury instructions that tell the jury you must specifically consider only conduct that arises after August 5th.
Yes, sir.
Why is that not sufficient under these circumstances?
Because it doesn't really cure the situation. If a jury is looking at American Family's conduct before the statute was enacted, they can't separate that. It's really kind of a legal fiction to say a jury can then separate its views of the facts that occurred after August 5 of 2008. It's really not curative of the problem that I'm trying to address.
Well, we have limiting instructions that are given to juries all the time on the use of evidence, for example, to ignore a fact in a criminal case, for example, a prior conviction or something of that nature. The jury can be told to limit their consideration of that to credibility. And we presume that they do, absent some kind of indication of the contrary. What we've got here is conduct occurring, of course, before August 5, as well as conduct afterward. And from what I saw on the record when I looked at it, it looks as if counsel limited the statutory claim to facts that arose after August 5th. Why is that not sufficient?
Because again, I think if a jury has looked at the evidence, it's impossible for them to look. Let's assume hypothetically a jury has reached the conclusion that the insurer's conduct prior to August 5, 2008 was unreasonable. It's impossible to separate that conduct from anything that might have occurred after August 5, 2008, particularly where what you have here is one of the critical problems that arises if these statutes are going to be applied to facts like these. What happened is after American Family had made its claim determination, it's very easy to manipulate the circumstances by waiting until the statute becomes effective. And I'm not being critical of counsel. It was good lawyering, quite honestly, to wait until the statutes became effective and then send another demand letter. And one of the questions that arises here is, when does it ever end? When does it ever end? If this statutory scheme is going to be applied to facts like this, then lawyers, insureds can always send another letter in. And it puts the insurers in that impossible position. We can't argue to the jury, of course, and this, I think, Judge, answers your question. We can't argue to the jury in that instance that this was really designed to bring this within this new cause of action. We can't make that argument because the jury doesn't get to make the determination about whether the statute is effective or not. So as a tactical matter, it puts the plaintiff's attorney in the driver's seat, in putting the insurance company in this place between the rock and the other hard place. And if we were allowed to argue to the jury, that's why you separate out this conduct. It might be one thing, but we can't do that and could not do that. And so to tell them that you can only consider conduct that occurred after August 5, 2008 leaves us without the ability to say, and that's why this letter was sent 7 months after the statutes became effective.
And undisputed that that's why that letter was sent?
No.
Okay.
No, I mean, we couldn't make that argument.
So you would have argued that they could draw that inference.
Absolutely. Absolutely. We would have argued that this was really designed to do this, particularly whereas here, what was sent was not something from a treating physician or someone this gentleman had seen. It was a 1.5-hour view by this physician who actually admitted at trial, if I had been told what, and this is another part of our argument that really isn't impacted by Kisselman so much, but if I had been told that, my conclusions would have been different.
Mr. Sands, the focus is on the conduct of American Family. So regardless of the motivation of why the letter was sent, wasn't the jury required to determine what did American Family do after August 5th?
That was the instruction that the jurors were given, certainly, Your Honor. But again, we are left without the ability to say to the jury, here is everything before, I could and did argue to the jury that everything that happened before August 5 of 2008 is off limits. But how effective can that possibly be when really what you do is allow people to do this sort of thing, and that is to send these letters after determination is made? And in fact, in the record, there is a statement made by counsel in brief that we do this all the time. We get final offers and settle for more. Well, that is exactly one of the problems with this statutory scheme if it is applied this way. Even not looking at the retrospective application issue, when does it ever end?
Since, did you ask the trial court to allow you specifically to argue, for example, that American Family had essentially been set up for a bad faith claim?
Well,
and did the trial court prohibit you from doing so? I hear you saying you couldn't make the argument. My question is, why not? I remember there's some other cases, for example, the Miller versus Byrne case specifically, where the issue was, can we tell the jury why this demand letter was sent at this point in time and had such a short time fuse? And I think the panel in that case said yes.
No, I respectfully disagree, Your Honor. The panel said motive may not be specifically addressed in the Miller versus Byrne opinion. They said that the motive may not be argued, but the circumstances surrounding the letters that were sent may be argued. And the circumstances surrounding the letter here that I was prohibited from arguing is that the statute became effective on this date, and that's why retrospective application on these facts would be inappropriate. So respectfully, Your Honor, again, Miller versus Byrne, I think that the holding was that you can't argue specifically the setup, but you can argue the circumstances, and I think infer. And I've tried setup cases because they come up all the time now. I mean, this is what we deal with. And under appropriate circumstances, such as Miller versus Byrne, the circumstances can be argued, but the circumstances here, where it's not the jury's for the jury to determine the applicable date or retrospective application or anything to do with the statutory scheme as it would apply on these facts, I couldn't do that because that's not the jury's province. So while the court didn't prohibit me from arguing the date of the that the statutes became effective, it wouldn't have been an appropriate argument because it's not the jury's province.
Well, you didn't present an expert on the bad faith of the statutory claim, did you?
We did not.
Would such evidence be admissible through an expert witness?
It's questionable whether it would be or not. The date of the statutes became effective. When you're looking at the conduct of the insurance company, may or may not have been, and I want to be careful about taking a position on whether it would have been admissible or not, because I'm just not prepared under all of the circumstances to say if there's a retrial, for example, here, what might or might not be admissible, given the evidence that might come out. But I question whether it would have been admissible for me to ask when did this statute become effective, and how does that affect American Family's conduct? There's something of a disconnect there, because what I'm suggesting here is that this is easily manipulable, and the this really does, as a matter of fact, become a retrospective application on these facts. The only way to reconcile this is to say this would de facto be a retrospective application, and on these facts, the Kisselman case doesn't give you the factual context, doesn't address that problem here. And I have to go back to what I said earlier, with 2.5 minutes left here, is that this application creates a real legal problem, and that is, does it ever end? Doesn't a letter like this, if it comes out at any time after a claim decision is made by an insurance company, no matter how long, won't the argument be made that the insurance company acted unreasonably under the statutes, even if, for example, under 1380.107.5, which applies specifically to UM/UIM cases, it's the limitations statute, let's say the claim for benefits is barred. Doesn't, based upon the Kisselman holding, if it were applied here, couldn't someone write a letter to the insurance company and say, well, even though my contract claim is barred, I'm sending you this letter now to invoke the statutory scheme, and we'll let a jury decide whether the insurance company acted unreasonably, meaning lacking a reasonable basis under the statute, and start the whole thing over and sue for the penalty and attorney's fees. It's an impossible situation for insurance companies that is entirely manipulable by people who want to invoke these statutes. I have a minute and 16 seconds left. I'd like to at least have an opportunity to respond a little bit.
Good morning. May it please the court, I'm Andrea Blansett. I'm here representing Charlie Vaccaro, the plaintiff in the underlying case and the appellee here. I want to start by addressing a couple of things that Mr. Sands said several times that I think are big issues in this case. One of the things that he's commented on several times is that somehow this creates an impossible standard for the insurance companies if a plaintiff's attorney can send them a letter sometime after the effective date of the statute in order to somehow set them up for a claim. My question would be, why doesn't the insurance company do the right thing in the first place? This, as Your Honor mentioned, this has nothing to do with conduct of the plaintiff. It's conduct of the insurance company. And if the insurance company acts reasonably, there is no claim.
The jury should have considered the conduct that occurred before the statute became effective?
No, Your Honor, that's not what I'm saying. And the jury in this case did not consider the conduct that happened before the statute became
effective. I understood you to say, why didn't they do the right thing in the first place?
Well, my point is, the letter that was sent, and this needs clarified as well, the letter that was sent after the statute went into effect was at the request of American Family. I contacted American Family and asked them, what additional information do you need? They told me, we need some additional information on permanency. That's why I went and got the medical exam done by Dr. Nadler. It's coincidence that it showed up to them after the statute went into effect, but at that time they conducted an independent evaluation based on that additional information. They had their nurse case managers that they typically use re-review the claim, re-review the information in there, review the additional information that I had provided from Dr. Nadler, and made an independent decision after the statute went into effect. That's the conduct that the jury considered, not what happened before that. And Your Honor, that's exactly why the jury instructions were so limited about what they could and could not consider. And if you look at the verdict forms, they are also very, very limited. Did American Family unreasonably delay or deny this payment after August 5th of 2008, or August 6th, whichever the date is? We did everything we could to limit the information and the conduct that the jury could consider. And we did call an expert witness to talk about their conduct. Defendants chose not to call any witnesses at all. So, I'm not sure. He had a witness lined up and simply chose not to call him. So I'm not sure factually what the concerns were with that. But, the difficult part with this case for me is that American Family is constantly claiming, well, it's not our fault. They sent us information after the statute went into effect, but the claim was before that. Well, no, it is them that made an independent decision after that statute went into effect on additional information that was provided at their request. I didn't make this up. I wasn't trying to set anybody up. And Mr. Sands did everything he could during trial to make me look like the bad guy. American Family and all insurance companies need to stand up and take responsibility for what they do. That's the purpose of the statute. Kissimmee makes it very, very clear that the General Assembly intended that this statute apply to actions that occur after enactment of the statute by the insurance company. Had they taken the information I provided them, made a reasonable decision, there would not have been a claim.
But how do you respond to the argument that Mr. Sands was not permitted to tell the jury why that date was important?
The jury was instructed several times that that was an important date. He didn't ask the judge if he could explain to her why. He did discuss at length with the jury the circumstances surrounding that medical evaluation that was provided to them. The jury was well aware of the reason it was provided, that American Family had asked for it, and they were also very well aware that that was the only conduct that they were to consider, nothing done before that. So in essence, Your Honor, I believe he did discuss that with the jury. He may not have been able to say it's because a new statute went into effect, and to be honest, I don't remember, but that may have come up. It's been a long time since I reviewed the trial transcript, but they were instructed very clearly that they were only to consider conduct after that date.
That's right. Why was evidence presented about pre-August conduct then?
The information that was provided to the jury was also in relation to an underinsured motorist claim. And as part of that claim, we provided the jury with information about the information, the medical records, medical bills, and why the case proceeded as it did. Our expert utilized the fact that American Family had made a previous evaluation and then made a new evaluation after August of 2011 to explain to the jury that there was additional conduct after that date. Mr. Sands' argument all through trial was, this all happened long before because we made our final determination in January. So we had to explain to the jury, no, while the numbers are the same, they made a new evaluation in September of 2008. So it was important contextually for them to understand. And that, quite frankly, was Mr. Sands' argument that made that happen. I want to move on real quick to the issue about whether there was sufficient information for the jury to find that they had violated that statute, and Mr. Sands has made an argument that it was fairly debatable. First of all, I think it's clear in Kisselman that a statutory claim and a common law bad faith claim are entirely different. Fairly debatable is a common law bad faith claim defense. The standards are different, and what we have to prove is entirely different. However, in this case, the jury heard all the information about American Family's conduct, and they were given an instruction about fairly debatable. And the jury factually determined that this was not, as Mr. Sands has indicated, that it was purely a value dispute. This was American Family not doing their job. And that's why they checked yes, that American Family had violated the statute and unreasonably and delayed payment to Mr. Vaccaro.
So you had a breach of contract claim in addition to your statutory claim, correct?
We had the UIM breach of contract, yes. Right. I did not have a common law bad faith claim.
You asked for that, but it was denied by the trial
correct.
Court. Okay. Why was the jury not asked to determine the date of the breach of the contract?
Quite frankly, Your Honor, based on the statutory language and the language in the jury instructions that they were only to consider conduct after August of 2008, I don't believe that was necessary. The jury instructions were discussed and agreed on by all of us, and that was the date that was put in them, that after this date did they violate that statute.
So your position at trial was that the breach occurred after August 5th or 6th?
Yes, Your Honor. And the jury apparently agreed. So as far as the fairly debatable is concerned, you know, I disagree that it's a viable defense to the statutory claim. It's a common law defense. The statutory claim is very specific that we have to prove unreasonable conduct, and it defines that in the statute.
Well, let me ask you, with the common law claim, isn't there unreasonableness must be proven as well, and wouldn't fairly debatable go to that?
To the common law claim, but that mm-hmm. was not what was presented to the jury.
All right. Well, with the statutory claim, you still have unreasonableness. It was other parts of a claim which are different from the common law, as far as knowledge or recklessness.
Sure.
Correct?
Yes, Your Honor.
But wouldn't fairly debatable go to reasonableness, or what is your argument?
Argument with reasonableness is it's very clearly defined in this statute, in this particular statute. It's not just a general unreasonable, you know, based on common law. It's very specifically defined in the statute what is considered unreasonable. Quite frankly, Your Honor, fairly debatable is something that the defense, insurance defense companies tend to throw around to cover anything that they do. To be honest, I'm not exactly sure if there's a clear definition of what fairly debatable is. Sometimes it's a facts decision. Sometimes it's a question of law. In this case, it appeared that Mr. Sands was arguing that it was simply a value dispute, and that's what he was claiming was fairly debatable. That information, the jury instructions were provided to the jury, and they didn't find that it was fairly debatable. And that is a jury question in this case. The only other issue in the appeal by American Family has to do with interest being applied to the underinsured motorist claim. And our position on that is simply that a first-party insurer should be held to the same standard as a third-party insurer, which is what the case law says. And just because they choose not to pay a claim that they should pay doesn't mean that they should only be limited to the insured's policy limits. Mr. Vaccaro did everything he could to get this claim paid long before we went to litigation on it. The American Family's choice was not to pay it. So now they're saying, well, that's all right, we didn't pay it, we only have to pay the limits anyway. And quite frankly, Your Honors, that's not fair to the insurance. That's not what insurance is for. then regardless of whether it's a first party or a third party claim, they are held to the same standards when it comes to payment of claims. So in fact, a first party insured tends to be held to a higher standard. If this was a third, I'm sorry, Your Honor, go ahead.
I was going to ask you on the interest issue. The argument that's being made before us now is that the trial court simply ignored the application of the Parker case to this, because, and Parker seems to say pretty explicitly that when you've got a claim for UIM coverage against your own insurer, then you're limited to those policy limits.
The Parker case also says that a first party insurer should be held to the same standards as a third party insurer when it comes to paying those claims. So,
but the standard is not what we're asking about here. The standard may be unreasonableness in terms of conduct, but a third party insurer who fails to pay a claimant and exposes its insured to an excess judgment, I see the logic in saying that they ought to pay more because they're the ones whose conduct precipitated the problem.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas here, you've got a clear policy limit of $75,000. That seems to be undisputed that that's what's left.
That's correct.
I don't understand the rationale for computing prejudgment interest when the maximum amount that American family could be obligated for was $75,000.
Well, Your Honor, the rationale is actually the same as you just articulated for a third-party claim. It was American family's actions that kept that claim from being paid. Mr. Vaccaro did everything under his policy that he was required and went beyond by having an independent evaluation of his own done at his own expense to try to get that claim paid. It was American family's actions that didn't get it paid. And that's the reason that both me and the trial court judge felt like interest should be applied to that.
Regardless of the blameworthiness of the conduct, it seems that the contract is the document that contains the limitation here. So given that we're dealing with interest only on the breach of contract claim, right? Not on the penalty.
That's the only appealed issue, correct?
So if we've got interest assessed only on the contract, doesn't the contract, if it in fact has a limitation, as this does, supersede this conduct argument?
I think it truly comes down to what the right thing to do is. And in this case, and in a lot of cases, you know, Mr. Vaccaro's claim was clearly worth his policy limits from the outset. And that's why there's a breach of contract claim. And if the contract is breached, the contract no longer controls. In this case, American Family is the one that kept that claim from being paid. Mr. Vaccaro did everything under the contract he was required to do.
I follow the legal reasoning of why the contract doesn't control if it's breached. Can't parties provide for liquidated damages? Can't they provide for any kind of remedy limitation in the contract, and courts, well, even if there's a breach, will enforce it?
As I'm sure you're aware, the insured has no control over what's in these contracts. That's entirely controlled by the insurance company. So no, he can't add in there a liquidated damages clause. And American Family certainly is not going to do that, because as with a lot of insurance companies, it's to their benefit not to. Which is why, unfortunately, it comes to the court to make those decisions.
So none of the provisions in the contract are binding on the insured?
No, Your Honor, that's not what I'm saying. What I'm saying is Mr. Vaccaro did everything under the contract that he was required to do.
I understand, but you're saying that in this particular instance we should ignore what the contract provides?
Yes, Your Honor, I am.
Okay. And is it because it's unconscionable, or?
I think it's clearly against public policy. If there aren't any other questions, I ask that the court affirm the trial court's rulings. Thank you.
I think I have a minute 16.
Minute nine.
The court asked, why was evidence of pre-statute conduct presented? And this is exactly the problem that we face on these facts, limited to a case like this, where the jury hears the evidence on the contract claim, and it's impossible to separate that from the post-letter, if you will, conduct, or the post-effective date. And that's exactly the bind we find ourselves in on these facts, is that the jury hears it all and somehow has to try to separate that out based upon, admittedly, that instruction. So when you have both claims going on at the same time, the jury's going to hear it all. It's not like the evidence is limited to what happened after the effective date of the statute. And again, I didn't have that opportunity. I don't think there's anything else for me to say on the prejudgment interest. One last comment. The letter that was sent with the last document was not at the request of American Family. This is addressed on page 5 of the brief, and the transcript, day 2, page 382, shows that it wasn't the request of American Family. Respectfully request that the matter be remanded for another trial. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. The case will stand submitted. Your arguments were very helpful, and an opinion will issue in due course. Thank you.